So in 2023, SpaceX plans to send a group of artists to the moon.
Who to the moon?
Artists.
People are going to go up there and draw and paint?
Yeah, I guess so.
That's pretty cool.
So if Elon Musk mm-hmm. decided he'd like to send up some trained astronauts with them, would you be interested?
Yeah, I'll go. Is that an offer or is that just a just a hypothetical?
I don't speak on behalf of Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Theoretically, if he said...
If he's listening.
Yeah. No, yeah, I'd love to go. I'm not sure I'd be the one to go, but if they offer it, I'd go. Sure, absolutely. I'll add my name to that list. Yeah, I'd love to go.
That's fair enough.
Yes, absolutely.
Welcome back to This Is Rocket Science, the official Columbia Space Initiative podcast. I'm your host, David Tibbetts.
I'm also your host, Henry Manowski.
What is this, episode 6 now?
Episode 6.
This is a very big episode for us.
This is a huge episode. Because today we have a very special guest that we're going to be interviewing.
An actual real-life astronaut who's been to space.
Yes, been to space multiple times. His name is Dr. Mike Massimino. He is a professor here at Columbia. He's also the faculty advisor for the Columbia Space Initiative. He's a really cool dude, he's super down-to-earth.
Henry, you told me actually you have a very good story about him in the pre-show.
So I said he's the faculty advisor for the Columbia Space Initiative, and because he is the faculty advisor, sometimes you get to sort of hang out with him. So earlier this year, there was a Mets game, and Mike Massimino is a super big Mets fan. He's actually thrown the opening pitch at a Mets game multiple times. It's crazy. So like maybe a dozen of us from Columbia Space Initiative, CSI, went with him to this Mets game, and the game ended, and we're going to take some pictures by the field. So we're all like standing on the edge of the field, like in the seating area.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were taking pictures and stuff, and one of the stadium security people came over and was like, "Hey, you guys got to get out of here." Like everyone was clearing out, so he's like, "Hey guys, like you got to get out of here. The game's over," and Massimino was just like, "Oh yeah, no problem, we'll head out, our bad." And that's when I realized I could never be an astronaut.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because if someone had come up to me, I would be like, "I've thrown the opening pitch at a Mets. Do you have any idea who you're talking to? Like, I'm a former NASA astronaut."
So, have you seen my resume? That's just a piece of paper that says, "I've been to space."
So yeah, he's super down to earth, very humble. Said that pun twice now.
It's a good pun. It holds up.
Yeah, it's pretty great. So we actually haven't recorded the interview yet. So I don't know what we're gonna really talk about or emphasize, but presumably it's gonna be great.
Oh yeah, it's probably gonna go a bunch of absolutely insane directions, and we're gonna have an incredible time. This time I'll actually be present for the interview, which would be significant improvement.
We'll be splitting the questions. We got some good questions from CSI members, so
yeah, it's gonna be great.
First question we had was just, what's your favorite thing about the astronaut corps? What's your least favorite thing? Do you miss it?
There's like three questions, right? Three. So the first one was, what was my most favorite thing about the astronaut corps? There's a few the things I enjoyed doing the most as an astronaut was spacewalking, and that was, I think, the coolest thing you could do in my era as an astronaut, getting a chance to spacewalk. And that involved training underwater in the pool. Was just really fun days when we did that. Just really interesting. Not always fun. You get your butt kicked pretty much when you're under there. It wasn't easy. You know, it was a lot of work and physically challenging, but it was probably the most enjoyable thing and my favorite thing. And flying in space and doing it in space. So that was my most favorite thing, spacewalking. Training and then getting a chance to do it in space. Flying a T-38 as well was really fun. I was a private pilot, but I never had a chance to fly in a high performance jet, and that's usually reserved for military heroes. And I had a chance to do a lot of that. I got about 1,000 hours in a T-38 in the back seat as a co-pilot, and that was extraordinary. I got to do that. So those are probably my two favorite things to do as an astronaut for activities, and probably even more favorite than that is the people I got to work with. They're the best people I've ever been around, and that goes for the older guys that came before us who I've gotten to know from the Apollo era. I'm fortunate enough to know a lot of those guys. And then the people that came before me in the shuttle, and even the folks even came after me. You know, this the whole group, but especially the people I got to work with and fly with. Those are my favorite, just the camaraderie we had going to work with these people. They're just incredible people. Best friends I've ever had. So that was the best. Those are the good things. The bad things, I think it's a little tough on a family, I think, at times. You know, there's a lot of stress. It requires you to really concentrate, which is kind of fun and challenging, but I think it also can sometimes put a bit of a strain on everybody at home at times. And that's but I think that's the way it is for a lot of jobs today. And there's always that mix of trying to find the nice balance between. I think the astronaut office, being an astronaut, adds an extra worry, which is you might get killed. And so, you know, most people aren't thinking about that when they're going to work, but that's that was part of our job. So I think it put a little bit of strain on the family. There's a lot of good things, I think, for the family as well, but I think it puts a little bit of a strain on them. What was your next question? Do I miss it? Yeah, I do. But you know what's interesting, guys, is that I kind of like what I'm doing now. And that's only happened in the last couple days. After five, no, I'm kidding. I really did miss it. I think what happened, I was an astronaut for 18 years, and you get used to a certain way of going about your life, I guess. And so I think what happened is that I was there for long enough that anything you're going to do after that, you got to kind of get used to. You know, it's a big transition. And so I don't think it was so much that I missed being an astronaut, because I felt like I was very happy with the career I had and the things I got to do, and was pretty satisfied with the way that went when I look back on it. So it's more that, you know, coming out and trying something different, it just takes a little while to get used to it. But I really like what I'm doing now. I like being here at Columbia. I really like CSI. It's probably the highlight of my job here, is getting to work with all of you in the CSI. And getting to know the students in my class and other faculty, and doing other things that I do. I wrote a book, and I do some television and things like that. I really enjoy, and I guess I'm starting to now get used to that routine. So I think I miss all of the things that I did as an astronaut, but I think it's a kind of experience that always stays with you. So. I kind of like what I'm doing now, so I actually don't miss it all that much anymore. I do, but certain things about it, but I really enjoy what I'm doing now.
So some of these questions, most of them were submitted by CSI members.
Okay.
So they're a little interesting. Mm-hmm. This one is, so in 2023, SpaceX plans to send a group of artists to the moon.
Who to the moon?
Artists.
People are going to go up there and draw and paint?
Yeah, I guess so.
That's pretty cool.
So if Elon Musk mm-hmm. decided he'd like to send up some trained astronauts with them.
Uh-huh.
Would you be interested?
Yeah, I'll go. I'll go. Yeah. Yeah. Is that an offer, or is that just just a hypothetical, I think, isn't it?
On behalf of Elon Musk. Yeah. Theoretically,
if he's listening.
Yeah. No, yeah, I'd love to go. I'm not sure I'd be the one to go, but if they offer it, I'd go. Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I'll add my name to that list. Yeah, I'd love to.
That's fair enough.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, so obviously, members of CSI, there's a lot of kids who want to become astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the question is, if they want to follow that career path, what are some things they should be doing to keep such a selective career path an option? Mm-hmm. And then also, more importantly, like, how do we keep what could be a far-fetched dream more realistic?
I don't think I'm going into your second question is, I don't think it's a far-fetched dream. I think that, I got to do it, and I can almost guarantee that everyone in CSI is as talented as I am, probably a lot more so than I am. So I don't think it's far-fetched for anyone to dream that, and especially the students we have in CSI. I think it's a real possibility. It might not work out for a number of reasons, and it was kind of miraculous that it worked out for me, but that doesn't mean it's a crazy dream. I think it's a good dream to have, and I think it can motivate you to do things that you might not normally do. I mean, for me, I wonder sometimes, I got the bug to really want to be an astronaut after I graduated Columbia, and I went to grad school, and I learned to fly in airplanes, and I took scuba lessons, and I did all these other things that I were kind of interested in, but I think, you know, thinking that it might help me with an astronaut career or a career at NASA, I think kind of gave me that extra little push to do a lot of things. And so I think it's good to have motivation behind you. If I never had a chance to become an astronaut, I think I would have ended up being a university professor. That's what I was doing beforehand. And then it worked out, and I left academics for 18 years, and now I'm back, but at a different school. I was at Georgia Tech before I was an astronaut. So, but I think even the motivation to become, get involved with the space program, if I would have never become an astronaut, I think I would have still worked with the space program and still would have enjoyed what I was doing. But, so I don't think it's a crazy dream. I think it's a good dream to have. And then what the CSI students can do, I think that you're all doing it. I mean, you're at a great school here at Columbia, and you're studying as hard as you can. And sometimes it's very challenging, as we talked about earlier. But I think, you know, the best thing you can do is just hang in there. And, you know, I thought about leaving engineering when I was a student here. I thought about maybe changing majors. I thought all kinds of things. I'm glad I hung in there. And I think that I would encourage them to do that. Just hang in there. Do the best you can. And, you know, maybe you don't always do as well as you'd like, but the important thing is to do the best you can. And so that would be the advice. And just do stuff you like. Follow things that you're interested in. There's no one set path. Every astronaut, I think it's going to keep going in the future in this way, that there's no set path. There are some in the military, I mean, you could say, or the test pilot route, you know, become pilots and test pilots and all that, but still, even in that, there's a lot of variation in the way the careers went for those people. For particularly for engineers and scientists who are civilians like I was, I mean, every path is different. So you should not necessarily pick a path to become an astronaut, but pick a path that you're interested in pursuing, because you're interested in that work and that's what you want to do to study and so on. And I think that will be the right path to lead you to be an astronaut.
So when you're flying on the shuttle, when do you first realize that you're in space? Because I know on the Soyuz,
mm-hmm.
second stage ends, power flight is over, and that's when you realize.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is that equivalent moment on the shuttle?
On the shuttle, it's when you have main engine cutoff. And you actually go through the, you know, whatever the boundary of space is. I think it's 100 kilometers or 50 miles. It depends who you talk to, I guess. But once you go, you get through that fairly, you know, a couple minutes, and then you get to orbit at orbital velocity when the engine's cut. So it's similar to that. It's when the second stage ends, our second stage on the shuttle would be the main engine cutoff. So that's when your engine's cut, all the violence stops, and you're still strapped in, but all of a sudden you realize you're in zero gravity.
Do you have to take like Dramamine or something? Like, how do you adjust?
You can tell, you know, because their motion sickness is an issue. We call it space adaptation syndrome, but that happens because your vestibular system is not working like it normally does. It works on gravity, and now that's not working in zero gravity, and so the nausea is pretty common. I threw up my first day in space. There are some things you can take. Not everyone can take them on the shuttle. Some of the pilot and commander, some of those anti-nausea medicines can sometimes make you a little sleepy or drowsy. That's not a good thing. So I don't think the people on the flight deck were able to take that stuff. On both of my missions, I was on the mid deck. I think, I can't really remember, but I think I might have taken something called a scope dex, which was a combination of scopolamine and dexa something or other, which kind of was a special, I don't know if it was a special NASA combination of medicine, but it was something to help us with the nausea and but not make you fall asleep. So I think that, I think we were able to take that. I remember taking that like on a zero gravity airplane that we would fly. The used to be the KC-135, now it's something else I think that they have going out there. But you know, if you were allowed to do it, I did that for the first day, if I remember correctly. For a launch, to try to help with that, because you want to be able to do your job, and if you constantly want to throw up, it's not.
Oh yeah.
It's hard to do anything, you know. So.
All right. So, what was your initial reaction when you heard that the Hubble was having gyro issues last month?
This last month? Yeah. So I was wondering, because I think, I think the gyro problem might have been with the reaction wheel, the bigger gyros that. I replaced one of them on my first flight, and it was one of the first corrections. It was one of that's the one I replaced. So that's a first thing. Uh-oh. But I think it's back. Is it back up and running now? Is the telescope...
I think there's enough reaction wheels that it's like pointing correctly and everything's fine.
Yeah.
But still there's like... Some,
they're really, I mean, they're really smart, their control team, and they've been at this for quite a while. The telescope launched in 1990, and of course they knew a lot about it when it launched, but after it launched, so it's, that's 28 years ago, right? So it's been up there quite a while, and they've gotten pretty good, they meaning the team, has gotten pretty good at figuring out how to keep the telescope going and turning the gyros and power on and off and battery life, all kinds of things they've learned about how to get the job done. So I guess I was thinking that, I had two reactions. One was that if I could get a spaceship and a spacesuit, I could, and I need 90 minutes. I just needed a wrench and a spacesuit and a spaceship, and we could replace that thing and get a new one in there in about 90 minutes. It's one of the easiest things you could do on a spacewalk. Honestly, but you just need to get there. But so that was one thing. But you know, I think you know, all of our qualified astronauts have no problem with it. But that's probably not going to happen. I don't think they're going to be able to replace it. But then, so my second thought was, well, you know, I think that team will be pretty good at figuring out a way to keep it going. And apparently, it looks like they have. So I have pretty good confidence they're going to keep the telescope working for as long as possible. And hopefully, it's got a lot of time left.
All right, great. Coming back to Columbia now.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you were a student. We have a lot of students listening to the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You have a favorite class you took while at Columbia?
Yeah, I've had a lot of them come to mind. You know, some of them were the ones that weren't engineering classes. You know, I was an engineering student here, but some of them were things. I remember I took a public speaking course. I don't even know if they have that anymore here, but it was taught by a guy who was actually an acting coach, I think. As it turned out, he was a drama guy, but he was really good at, I think it was effective public speaking or public speaking or something like that. That was actually a pretty good course, very useful. And I remember taking some economics courses. There was one, it was called the Economic History of the United States, which was really interesting. I think that...
Yeah.
Professor left like after the she taught the course to when I was in it, and you know, going back a long time ago, and we're going back over 30 years ago apparently, because I graduated from the school 35 years. Oh my gosh. So anyway, wow, is that possible? Yeah, I guess it is. Anyway, so some of those classes I took in those areas, some were from some interesting professors like that, those two I mentioned. From the engineering side of it, one of my favorites was actually I was an industrial engineering student here, which I think the curriculum might have been different back then than it is now. We didn't have financial engineering or any of that back then, but we had I remember taking a couple courses in human factors, and people interacting with machinery and airplanes and that sort of thing, and that kind of got, I thought that was really interesting. And so when I wanted to go to grad school, I went into mechanical engineering and got more into those problems of human and machine cooperating in robotics, a little bit about, you know, manipulators and how people could control those. But I think the course that probably set me on the path was the human factors courses that I took when I was here. So again, you know, not necessarily the traditional engineering classes. I enjoyed those as well. I remember circuits class and mechanics, and all those were taught really well and really good classes. All the stuff you take here is, I think, very useful. It teaches you how to think and solve problems. But I think the ones that, you know, some of the different electives, or no, these weren't electives, but I think they were required at the time, the human factors was for my major. I think those are probably the ones that you know, that inspired me to learn more about that as I got older.
So how has Columbia changed over the years? I don't know what dorm you were in or something like that.
I was in McBain. They renovated that. Carmen, I'm not sure if they renovated
Carmen.
It. Then I lived over in East Campus. And then I lived in a frat my last year. But it's changed. The students are a lot smarter. This place is near impossible to get into now. Back when I applied, you could look up the data. It was not as difficult to get into Columbia back then. I think that's the way it is for a lot of things. You know, it's just, but Columbia's reputation, especially in engineering school, has really skyrocketed. It's an amazing place. There also was back then, when I first started as a student here, the college was not co-ed. Columbia College was still all men back then. And the engineering school did not have a lot of women in it back then. It was still, I don't know if it was maybe less than 10%. I don't know what the numbers were, but it wasn't very many women here. And now, that's changed. It's a co-ed school and a college, and the engineering school is about 50-50, which is great. It opens up a lot more opportunity. And so that's changed in that regard. I think there's more opportunity for different students, gender, ethnicity, and so on. So it's changed in that way. I think engineering has changed as well, and the world has too, which is a good thing. As I said, the students have gotten really smart, and the school's gotten very difficult to get into. And I think that's good too. I think that's a good mark of improvement for the school. And the New York City, the biggest difference though is really the New York City itself. I mean, New York City back in the 1980s was a much different place. And now it's just flourished. It's a really beautiful surrounding area around here. Campus is beautiful. It always was pretty, but now the campus I think is even nicer than it was. There's buildings popping up all over the place, you know, what's going on up. I mean, we haven't really seen the full effect of that yet, I guess, what's going on up in Manhattanville, and in just the surrounding area, the parks, the areas in Morningside Heights and into Harlem and around here has just improved, and they're safe, and they're beautiful areas. So the ability to enjoy the city has, I think that's the biggest difference. It wasn't quite like that. You always have to be careful no matter where you are anytime, but the city has just gotten to be extraordinary and so enjoyable and such a great place to be. So I think the combination of what we have here is a school at Columbia and this great campus we have and everything it has to offer on campus and educationally, and then you combine it with what New York City has become now. And I think it's going to continue to grow in that area for opportunities for internships and in culture and media center and financial center and so on. I think it's a pretty tough place to beat as far as the experience you can get being a student here. So it's gotten a lot better. It really has, and I'm happy to see that happen.
So, all right, so we're coming into our final question now.
All right.
So do you have any stories about maybe your career broadly, your time as an astronaut, just anything that sticks out in your mind that you want people to know about, I guess?
There's a lot of stuff, I guess. But I think looking at it, when I was a student here, looking back on it, I felt like I was always kind of anxious about things and worried about lots of things and not sure what I wanted to do. And I think that that's okay. I think that the important thing is knowing that, especially if you're a Columbia student here, you're in a good place. And you got a lot in front of you and a lot of living to do in front of you and a lot of great opportunities. And there's that flexibility in there. And, I didn't decide on trying to pursue the astronaut career until after I graduated from Columbia. Really didn't think about it at all. To me, it was like trying to be, before that, it was like trying to become a cowboy or something, or a circus clown. It was like, it was just like, dang, real people don't do that. And I didn't decide to pursue it until afterwards. And I think a lot of that, the nerve to try, I think, came from being here at Columbia, that people do extraordinary things here and when they get out. And so I thought, why not, maybe it can happen. And I guess I would just, want everyone to know that there's a lot of fun stuff ahead of you. And do the best you can to enjoy your time here in college, and if you get out and you decide you don't like what you're doing, I enjoyed my first job when I got out, but it really wasn't what I was passionate about, and I wanted to make a pretty serious change in direction, and I was able to do that. I wasn't at a disadvantage because I had gotten that good start at Columbia, and I thought I was behind the curve because I was late in deciding, but it was fine, and actually ended up getting, I was one of the younger people that were selected in my astronaut class, as it turned out. So, you know, you have a lot of flexibility ahead of you. Make the best decisions you can. Don't do anything really dumb. You know, don't hurt yourself. Don't do anything stupid. Try to make good decisions and take care of yourself. And, you know, you're going to have a very bright future. I'm confident in all of you two guys here sitting in front of me and all the students at CSI. You guys have a lot of fun stuff ahead of you, so keep that in mind.
This is Rocket Science, is the Columbia Space Initiative podcast, featuring guest star and space ranger, Dr. Mike Massimino. Produced by Henry Manelski and David Tibbetts. Executive producer, Millen Anand. Creative director, Elise Palma. Audio is by Michael Weiss.